From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's not really all that easy to tell what William Shakespeare thought of women by looking at his female characters, because they changed over time. At first, they were pretty lightweight, ingenues who needed men, or shrews who needed to be brought back in line by men. But somewhere along the line, things changed. Shakespeare started to create women characters who were wise and witty and independent. Take the play Much Ado About Nothing, which is playing at the Utah Shakespeare Festival. The play's director, David Ivers, says not only is it the best romantic comedy ever written, it's the result of Shakespeare's evolution on the subject of the Battle of the Sexes. Today in the program, we're live in Cedar City at the Shakespeare Festival, talking about the women in Shakespeare's world and in his plays. Join us after the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West, and Doug Fabrizio. One of Shakespeare's great characters is Beatrice in Much Ado About Nothing. For the last several weeks, audiences here in Cedar City at the Utah Shakespeare Festival have seen Kim Martin Cotton in that role. She's great, by the way, as you'll see here shortly. What's interesting about the role, though, is just how self-assured she is, how witty and bawdy and how independent. When we first meet her in the play, she's not exactly a maiden, a little older, certainly wiser. She's been in love before, didn't work out, and now she seems perfectly happy as a single woman, not having to, as she puts it, make an account of her life to a clod. And by modern standards, no big deal, right? But what did an Elizabethan audience some 400 years ago make of Beatrice? Today in the program, we're talking about Shakespeare's women, the way his characters evolved, and the play Much Ado About Nothing is the perfect way, really, into this conversation. We're live again at the Eccles Promenade of the new Ingolstadt Shakespeare Theater in Cedar City, talking about all of this. And I just want to warn audiences that there may be some references to sex. It is a Shakespeare play, after all. Just want to warn you. Let me introduce who's with us today. We have with us, I mentioned Kim Martin Cotton. She plays Beatrice in this production. Among the other women of Shakespeare, she's played Lady Macbeth 6 times. Kate in Taming of the Shrew 3 times. There's a really long list. We'll actually talk about this. But Kim Martin Cotton, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
David Ivers, co-artistic director of the Utah Shakespeare Festival, with us. He directs Much Ado About Nothing. He's, of course, an actor, as many of you know. He's played Benedict, by the way, twice, and other characters in Much Ado, and he's joining us here as well. David, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Kate McPherson is with us, a literary scholar who specializes in the English Renaissance, including Shakespeare. She's a professor of English and directs the honors program at Utah Valley University. She's joining us here in Cedar City. And Professor, welcome to you.
Thanks very much. Thrilled to be here.
David Ivers, so let's just orient people on what's happening in Much Ado About Nothing. Give us the basic plot line. It's long. It's complicated. Do your best.
Boy met girl, boy had relationship with girl, something happened. basically, Shakespeare wrote this play somewhere probably in the middle of 1598, 1599. And these men are coming back under the guidance of Prince Don Pedro from a war that is really hard to figure out where it is and where it's located in the world. They're returning, and they're returning to Leonardo's estate. Leonardo is the father of Hero, who is the young woman, one of the young women in the play, and a young Count Claudio finds himself his initial feelings about this young Hero when he returns to Leonardo have been sort of bolstered. And he says, I liked her ere I went to wars, but now, after 2 or 3 years away, this sounds familiar to Utah audiences, maybe. I've come back, and I'm really in love. I might want to take this relationship to the next level. And also returning with that regimen, of course, is Benedict. The reason I talk about Hero and Claudio is because in the synopsis of the play, I actually feel like Hero and Claudio are the main plot, and that the subplot is actually Beatrice and Benedict. People, we can argue about that later. But essentially, thus begins a journey of Leonardo, the father, saying, "Hey, I want you all to stay. Don't go home. Stay at my estate for a month." You know, wash off, have some wine, have some olive oil, some food. And in the interim, Don Pedro's bastard brother, Don John, creates a little bit of mischief to get in the way of all of these soldiers sort of finding their identity or reconnecting with their identity in partners. Benedict and Beatrice, we learn, definitely have a history. Thus begins their battle of wits and the battle of sexes in some ways. Hero and Claudio succumb to the machinations of Don John's kind of evil plot, without giving, I guess, too much away, about hearsay, which we'll get into later, I'm sure. And we hurtle towards a series of misrepresented positions in the play, all to do with couples getting together, essentially, including characters like Baraccio, who is sort of a henchman to Don John, and Margaret, who's a waiting gentlewoman for Beatrice. And we end up eventually getting to the end where all is righted, and thus we end with, essentially, in my opinion, the greatest romantic comedy ever written. How's that for a wandering synopsis? <That's great. laughs>
Best romantic comedy ever written. So where do you sort of situate it in terms of Shakespeare's work? I think, Kate, you think it's one of the best comedies, if not the best?
It's my personal preference for all of Shakespeare's comedies, and I have a pitched battle with my spouse, who's also an English teacher, about whether this play or Twelfth Night is the most perfect romantic comedy. I fall on the side of Much Ado, simply because of the, I think, more maturity in the characters, and I don't know. I think it's just laugh out loud funnier. So in terms of the comedy aspect, I think it wins out. Twelfth Night has many virtues and much depth to it.
Kim, what about you? Where do you situate this play in terms of the roles that you've played? What do you think about it?
I certainly think Beatrice is a fantastic woman. She is both funny and strong. She has a lot to say. It's nice when a woman that he's written sort of pours forth, and in the comedies, she definitely is one of those women who pours forth and sort of is unstoppable in sharing her opinion with the world.
Yeah.
frequently married to humor, but then sometimes when it needs to be, with frankness and passion and fury. So I love all of that.
Yeah. David, one of the things you've talked about, the Elizabethan audience would have heard Much Ado About Nothing, maybe differently, Much Ado About Noting. Like, this is an important point.
It's a huge point, and actually became the entrance for me to the play. Even having worked on it as an actor in several different productions, but never having directed it, you know, the word nothing would have been pronounced and received noting. I started to really examine the play from that point of view. What do people hear? What do you note? What do you take down? What do you perceive? And all of a sudden, looking at the play in that way, one recognizes Shakespeare's genius in that really the first line of the play is, I read here in this letter a note, you know. Mm-hmm. I hear, I see, there is not a single plot or subplot in this play that doesn't get fired out of a cannon without it being heard or overheard. It really,
and everyone believes what everyone else says.
They have to. The play. We had many discussions about this because our modern sensibility wants to justify, which I totally get. We want to look at it through our worldview and our lens, and we want to justify. But as soon as you can out justify yourself into the magic of the theater, very quickly, and the play is dependent upon people fully investing in what others say. And I've said several times that what has revealed itself in this particular production in terms of audience response more than others is that There's this contradiction in audiences who sort of hate, which I understand why, the issues around Margaret and the issues around Claudio. But you're not allowed to do that if you also buy into the same device that brings Beatrice and Benedict together, because it is the same device. They overhear something, they believe it, and they fall in love, and we love it. But we don't like it when you overhear something bad and people believe it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's a very brilliant construction that the exact same device that Shakespeare uses to frame you getting hooked in the mouth about Beatrice and Benedict is the same device mm-hmm. that he uses for us to malign other characters.
I want to put another spin on the title that I read about. The Shakespeare scholar Tina Packer wrote this book about Shakespeare's women characters, and she pointed out that the title also has another meaning on nothing being no thing. Thing for the Elizabethans being a man's penis. So as Packer puts it in her book, the play's title could also mean much ado about no thing, much ado about a vagina, presumably heroes. So let's talk about that, this focus on, not sex necessarily, but the way it revolves around heroes' virtue or virginity. Will you guys talk about that?
Sure. I was thinking about this issue after I had been invited onto the show, and I was reminded of the section in Hamlet where he asks Ophelia, "Lady, shall I lie in your lap?" And then it proceeds to, you know, that's a fair thought to lie between a maid's legs. What, my lord? Nothing, right? No thing. And so it's pretty clear from the lingo of the time that the audience would have gotten that joke, and that a woman's chastity was her primary currency. And if she had that, nobody regarded her for any other virtue. And if she lacked that, that's the only thing that they looked at. And so it's a real problem for Hero. This is why she falls down in such a swoon when she's accused of unchastity. And so that issue of her thing is a thing in the play.
I guess this gets to your point, David, about Claudio and Hero's sort of their plot line being the central one. It's built around her, right?
I think it has to be.
Yeah.
I think it has to be because that the dramatic action, you know, the conflict in the play, the central thing we hang our hat on as theater practitioners, that's where it sits in the play. And to not pay attention to that does actually, in my opinion, a disservice to the Beatrice and Benedict storyline. They're witness to it. And how those characters and other characters process the information of what they're witnessing sets them on a different journey.
Yeah.
It fundamentally changes their temperature as they move forward after that wedding. And I think not to explore that for all its value pulls us away from what he wrote.
Kim, I wanted to ask you about, on one hand, I mentioned Beatrice being pretty earthy and body, but mm-hmm. by the same token, she's also outraged at this, you know, besmirching of her dear cousin's character. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about that seeming contradiction? She's outraged by it, but she's also world-wise in all of those things.
Well, I do think that Beatrice has no parents. She's part of this family in a very, very integrated way. I feel like, you know, for myself as an actor, it's helpful for me to think of Hero as a little sister, as even sort of acting, because Hero doesn't have a mother, in some ways participating in her life from that perspective.
Yeah.
And a peer-like relationship with my uncle. So I feel like as the woman in the household who very clearly in the wedding doesn't have a voice, she's not able to step in and say, "Hey, this is not right."
Yeah.
She understands something has gone awry. And she, as many of Shakespeare's women do, understand a truth that is not being seen by others. And when Leonardo is so drawn into Hero must have done this, then her fury for the outing of the truth rises in her, but she cannot, in the conditions of the wedding, express it in that public moment. And so the scene with Benedict after is where she is able to say all the things that were welling just moments before. And I don't think it's a contradiction in her. I think it's until this crisis, life is good, even if she has a conflict with her former friend Benedict.
Yeah. We'll get to that scene because it's crucial and beautiful. But you raised the question that Hero doesn't have a mother. And Kate, would you talk about that? Throughout Shakespeare's characters, they don't have their mothers around. What gives?
It's a fascinating pattern that repeats itself throughout so many of the plays. The subject of a famous scholarly article some years ago called The Absent Mother in King Lear, and other, you know, sort of feminist analyses of Shakespeare's works that observe how frequently there is this absence in the family, which would have been very unusual in the social conditions of the time. Serial monogamy was the norm in Shakespeare's time. Yes, people married and their spouses died with distressing frequency, and then they remarried, both men and women. Stepfamilies were very typical in the time period, and so the idea that there's play after play, Othello, King Lear, Much Ado About Nothing, sure, Twelfth Night, Shrew. I mean, you can just keep going. The list goes on and on about how many plays there are where there's no mother figure and very often no maternal figure, not even a substitute mother. Romeo and Juliet is an outlier in that regard. We get two, both the mother and the nurse, in that play. And so it's very strange in this play. And on occasion I've seen this play powerfully staged where Leonardo's wife, as a non-speaking character, appears on the stage, and that changes the dynamic of the wedding scene quite a bit. It's a fascinating modification of the text in addition to the dramatis personae to have Leonardo's wife and Hero's mother there.
How much does the play really touch on women and their relationship to men? David, one of the things you've pointed out is that this play is kind of the result of this evolution for Shakespeare. But it's... Is it about women, really? I mean, or about women's place? I mean, it touches on that, but not really about that.
I don't think so, as much as it is about contextualizing your personal life, your family life, and your environmental life as it relates to somebody else. Mm-hmm. You know? That's what's powerful, I think, about the Margaret track, you know, in a way, is she's bound to a set of circumstances by the household she serves, but she's willing to fracture that outside to find maybe a context that she can't find inside of the house for independence. I don't know the reasons. I wish I could ask them about the lack of mothers, but I have opinions about it. Being a man that has a close relationship with my mother, I don't know that I'd want to write about it. Well, I'm not kidding. I mean, it's very personal and wonderful, but that really fractures a man's world. And it's a very, you know, so there is a part of me after working on so many of the plays and as inside of them as an actor that sort of understands the privacy of that in a way. Mm-hmm. But we did talk about it, and I think that these characters have to have a presence about it, and the actor does, about how they think through family relationships. I mean, we joked about this play a little bit, or I joked about that, you know, the subtitle could be When You're Here, Your Family. Like, you show up in Messina, and then everybody, you know. All of my plays are taken from TV commercial slogans or advertising. That used to be the Olive Garden slogan, by the way. When you're here, your family.
Is that your secret to success?
Yes.
I wonder if this idea of Beatrice being the kind of this feminist icon for some, because people talk about it. I wonder if you were acting, you can't really think about that. Like, you have to put that aside. It can sort of paralyze the way you approach the role.
Well, I certainly think that all I think about is what kind of person am I within the words. Sure, I think this is a woman who says whatever she wants to, except until we get to that wedding scene. But I do feel like she has a freedom, she has a confidence, she is fine on her own. She understands a lot about the world, and I do think that she has a voice that is clearly outspoken. And And truly, yes, I don't think of that as being, this is a feminist role,
yeah.
But I feel the freedom of her and the robust expression of what she feels free to do in her world, which is wonderful. So, I don't spend much time as an actor living within that idea, but I love that she can be the loudest person on stage.
Yeah, yeah. She often is, yeah.
I wanted to jump in and say, I think that she is given an extraordinary amount of freedom within her family to speak. Her uncle is remarkably accepting mm-hmm. of who
is.
She is. And when she has that long and wonderful joke about leading apes in hell, the traditional punishment for old maids, mm-hmm. this is clearly a great joke within her family. They're all very amused by it. Rather than being shocked and ashamed, she is not a burden to her family because she's an unmarried woman. And that alone makes her a standout character. I think, in the canon of Shakespeare's work.
But is Shakespeare saying something about women in it? Or one of the things you've talked about is that, look, let's be honest, what was driving Shakespeare was he needed to fill seats. So there was that practical part of it, too, as opposed to making some social commentary about women in Elizabethan society.
Yeah, I think that the key to, you know, sort of seeing her place is that I think Shakespeare was entertained by the idea and knew it would entertain his audiences to create this woman that had this freedom. And certainly there were unmarried women in Elizabethan England, Elizabeth herself being chief among them. And so having an outspoken woman who's going to say whatever she pleases and gets her way, ultimately in the end, you know, it may have been something that was a current running through the culture. Not everybody liked it. There was a good deal of anti-feminist literature in the time period, tirades about women and the monstrous regiment of women and, you know, all kinds of pamphlets published and this kind of thing. It's really interesting to take a look at. But Beatrice, no one stops her, and they don't stop her mouth until Benedick is kissing her, of course.
I mean, you know, it's funny because obviously, I'm a huge fan of Shakespeare, but I don't know that we can give him too much credit here for being ultimately so feminist, because these are written for men. I mean, there were men playing these roles, you know. We can give him credit for writing strong characters.
But clear that up, because just for those who don't understand, there was a ban. Women could not perform on an Elizabethan stage.
That's right. So his company, these were men. Playing women, so to give him
often boys, yeah?
Yeah, and also actors save the day all the time with a lot of bad scripts and a lot of bad directors. They've saved me countless times. But so if you have an actor in mind in your company, let's say, you know, Brian Vaughn's going to play Beatrice, that actor, right, is bringing a voice at this time. This was a new play once, you know? It was heard for the first time. And that actor sets a track, you know? And that evolution I'm interested in. But you know, let's be clear that the credit goes to him for writing. It's a very modern play to our ear. That's what's astonishing to me about it. More than almost any of his other plays, it sounds so incredibly modern. And then the relationships within it are matched, because we say things like, I'm going to live a bachelor. You know, and we all have an idea about what that's about, especially when you say it to your friends, and then you see the woman that you're quote in love with, and you say, I want nothing to do with you,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so he understood how to write that, but he was by no means saying, I'm gonna celebrate women here, because otherwise that ban would have been fought more than it was, you know?
How long did it last, Kate, the ban?
It wasn't officially lifted until the theaters reopened at the English Restoration in 1660. King Charles II, in fact, who had grown up in France watching women on the stage, it was only England that had this bizarre custom of teen boys playing women's characters, lifted the ban and outlawed, in fact, the cross-dressing roles. And so he himself was an enthusiastic theater goer and lover of actresses. Specifically.
Kate McPherson, a professor of English and director of the Honors Program at Utah Valley University. Kim Martin Cotton plays Beatrice in the production of Much Ado About Nothing here at the Utah Shakespeare Festival. David Ivers is co-artistic director of the festival. He directs the production. The play runs through September 8th here at the festival. You can find links and more information on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, one more show from the Utah Shakespeare Festival. We're talking about Shakespeare's women, the way he wrote about women, what it tells us about the attitudes of the day, and more importantly, how Shakespeare may have changed over time. The Utah Shakespeare Festival is performing Much Ado About Nothing. It's a good model to talk about the role of women in Shakespeare's world. We have with us Kim Martin Cotton, who plays Beatrice in the production. David Ivers directs the production. He's also the co-artistic director of the Shakespeare Festival here in Cedar City. And Kate McPherson is a professor of English and director of the Honors Program at Utah Valley University. Kim Martin Cotton, I wanted to ask you about... So I have written down here somewhere like this litany... Yes, here it is, of the roles you've played. I mentioned Lady Macbeth 6 times, uh-huh. Beatrice twice, uh-huh. Kate from... Taming of the Shrew 3 times. Mm-hmm. And there it is. For those of you here, you can sort of see the litany of all of these. And I'm wondering, I'd be interested in comparing later Beatrice and Kate, but what do you think you've been able to learn playing all of these roles over time about, like, do you detect a change in the way Shakespeare wrote about women? Do you think about it all that much, given what we were talking about earlier?
I guess I'm not as engaged in the timeline as an actor, but I learn a lot about what he writes about women constantly, and also depending on where I am in my life and what I'm experiencing in my life, it always informs what I'm learning about those women. And what I do know is he wrote with incredible nuance, so that there is so much room for depth with all of them. I've once played a rustic, which is not on that list, and that was the only time that it was sort of wide-eyed and simple, and that was Audrey in As You Like It.
Yeah.
And all the other women, I find, have this variety of places you can take them, which is part of the brilliance of his writing, is that you can have 5 different women step into a role, and they all have incredible nuance and have different voices to bring to it. And that's something that I hear over and over again as I spend time with his work.
You often hear Catherine from Taming of the Shrew in contrast with Beatrice, that Kate is a shrew to be tamed. Is that a good contrast? Is that a good... I mean, she's a kind of a controversial character, Kate, in Taming of the Shrew. What do you make of that as someone who's played both of them?
Well, actually, David and I talked about it a bit. One of the differences in these outspoken women, I think, is that Beatrice is fine with her situation, and she's well-loved by her family, and her whatever she chooses seems to be very accepted by her family. Kate is in an entirely different position in the world. She has a father who's decided and publicly stated that he will marry her off first before the younger daughter is able to be married. And so she is regarded as a difficult woman by her world. She pushes back at that, but I don't know that she's completely fine with her conditions. It is a prickly relationship she has with the world and with her family, and even if she has some fun doing so, which you can, I do believe there's some pain of being the outsider in Kate, at least for my sensibilities as an actor. I find some there that is not the same in Beatrice, even if she has an old wound from her former friend Benedick. But I do think that Kate is wrestling with things in her society that Beatrice is not wrestling with.
Yeah, I really I think that Kim is right on with that, because Kate frequently referred to as cursed and shrewd, two words which are also applied to Beatrice in Much Ado About Nothing, but it's jokingly, it's lighthearted, it's not the judgment and the censure that Kate receives in The Taming of the Shrew, and she's in such a tenuous position. Her father says he's going to wait for her consent to marry her, that she has to, you know, Petruchio has to earn her love, and then when Petruchio shows up in all his outrageousness, does whatever he wants, the father says, okay, you're going to marry him anyway, even after humiliation at the wedding scene, another interesting echo of what he picks up again in Much Ado.
I want to ask about Beatrice and Benedick. I think what's so interesting about Beatrice is they've had something in the past, right?
Yes.
I guess we're not sure exactly what, but something. Clearly love and sort of, and it was tumultuous and something happened. But is it significant that for a Shakespearean character that she has a past, that she's rebuilding a relationship? Is that somehow new?
I'm scanning my brain for another example, but I don't think it's a frequent theme, and I think that it is a condition that is sort of unique in his romantic comedies, for sure. And I love that it's vague, but I love that there is a bit of language to talk about it.
Yeah.
In a moment when Beatrice interrupts Benedick railing about how he feels about her and how outraged he is at what happened at the masked dance, where she talks frankly or knows he is the guy behind the mask and pretends she doesn't and says horrible things. But then she has to say to the prince and her family, yes, once before, he won my heart from me. He won it from me with false dice. And so it does really say, truthfully, there was something between us, and I think shared, mutually shared. And I do think that, I can't think of another place where there is an old relationship that is rekindled.
David, talk about this, because it's so interesting. It's, and even the way you've cast it with, because there can be younger Beatrices and Benedicts.
Yeah.
Yes.
I didn't know how to approach that, Ken.
It's a little... Yeah, I always say, you know, they talk about writers write from what you know.
Yeah.
And I think the same sometimes applies for directing, you know, at a certain age. But 2 points. One, back... I'll speak about Beatrice and Benedict and their age in this production in a second, but back to this point about, you know, sneaking in this brilliant little thing about a past inside of this play, which, again, is a very modern moment of, oh, yeah, we had a relationship. Other characters like Kate or Olivia, Kate in True or Olivia in Twelfth Night, their movement in a play is on a trajectory of immediate information. We're finding you a husband so Bianca can get married. You're in mourning, Olivia. So this contextualizes your world for a certain period of time. And those things set a path for character and for other characters. And here we have what we think is a path. And then somewhere along the line, you know, 20-some-odd minutes in, we hear this little gem of, which is so helpful, I think, to an audience and does raise eyebrows of, oh, yeah, he had my heart, but he won it with false dice. You know, and it's just such a beautiful thing because it gives us history. And we sometimes don't get history that way, including male characters that occupy, but particularly with women, and I think it's a good point. Beatrice and Benedick here in this production, I chose to cast a bit more mature. They're not that old.
You're not.
They better not be, or else... to admit something about myself I'm not willing to do.
They have to climb trees.
This is part of the reason.
Yeah.
You know, the set you can look at as I call the set my personal farm-to-table restaurant. but the set, is essentially what you might find in this orchard, you know. But if you look at it with another set of eyes, it becomes a sort of jungle gym for people that really shouldn't be climbing all over things, you know. And that speaks, I hope, to what lengths they go to be a part of each other's life. But really, the fundamental reason I chose to cast it this way is twofold: Kim and Ben. That's it. The second, that's all I'll say about it. And the second part is, I was interested in, when's the end stop? At what point, when you have history with someone and you know that there's chemistry there, what does it take to remove pride? And for me, it became very clear that witnessing what happens between Hero and Claudio at the beginning of their journey does something, I think, to someone at a certain place in your own relationship to say, this is our last crack at this, you know? And look what happens, look what can happen at the first time. And I think that there was something about that to me that seemed poignant, and also these two actors are just people I really wanted to work with in these roles.
Yeah. Kate, did you have anything?
Oh, I was just going to say, I think that speaking to the issue of the past that they might have shared, I was very drawn to the interpretation of, I think it's Beatrice's first line about Benedict returning from the wars, and the spin that Kim puts on it is wonderful. Can you tell people what that is?
Sure. I say, I pray you, is Senior Mount on to return from the wars or no?
It's marvelous.
It's Montanto, really, is how it's...
So it's definitely a spin, but it speaks to the potentially physical past they might have shared, or at least the attraction of that past between them, which clearly informs everything that goes after that, and Benedict's long protestations that he is going to live a bachelor ring all the more hollow with that backstory in mind, I think.
These scholars, I thought it was about riding horses.
Okay, so we talked about absent mothers, we talked about the importance of chastity. This struck me too. So Leonato, the governor of Messina, his daughter is Hero, and when he learns or thinks that his daughter is unvirtuous, he wishes that she were dead. And this is something that Tina Packer and others have written about. Packer says that fathers who want their daughters dead in Shakespeare's plays are thick on the ground. Capulet and Lear, and she goes through this list. Kate, you want to say something about that? What's that about, this idea of virtue? I guess it wasn't uncommon for the time for a woman's character to be besmirched, that family would rather she be dead, but there's a lot of this in Shakespeare too, I guess.
Yeah, there was just such a strong sense that a woman's primary value lay in her marriageability, and if her chastity was impinged in any way, she was not marriageable, and if she were married and her marital chastity was impinged, that was the fracturing, the permanent loss of her marital relationship. And so women's status being determined by their allegiance or alliance with men, I think, really lies behind this. I think that it's interesting to think about Much Ado About Nothing as the kind of flip side of the coin for Othello, that there is this sort of inverse pattern. In Othello, right, this, you know, sudden marriage between two people, great passion and love, fractured by the machinations of a terrible, terrible villain. You get the same happening in Much Ado. In Much Ado, the beautiful young woman apparently dies. In Othello, she actually dies. And so I think that preoccupation with female chastity, which is the turning point in Othello, also the turning point in this play.
It's interesting that you say that, because that's also the play where the speech from Cassio, reputation, reputation, mm-hmm. reputation, I have lost my reputation, that immortal part of myself, and what remains is bestial. That immortal part of myself, I think, is at the forefront of Shakespeare's male characters, myopic or not, in our modern world, about what do I leave behind? What does my family name leave behind? In this play, it has all sorts of ramifications for his work, his orchard, his everything, you know? And I think he's working with two things there, Shakespeare, you know. Potent.
Would women have been in the audience in these plays?
We believe that women attended the live performances of Shakespeare's plays in Renaissance England, not in as great numbers as men. The audience was primarily made up of men about town, apprentices, other, you know, people who had some leisure time and could go to the theater. Women would have seen performances of Shakespeare's plays when they were command performances at the court, and so female courtiers would have seen them at that time. But it's a much smaller percentage of people in the audience who would have seen the play would have been female.
I wonder if it was... the fact that it was kind of earthy and a lot of sex and stuff like that, would that have been what was the audience? Was it kind of the blue collar audience? Would the nobles have enjoyed it? Would women have blushed? You know what I mean?
I think that it's interesting to think about the past. We tend to presume that people in the past were perhaps more prudish than they were. That may have been largely a 18th and 19th century invention in Shakespeare's time. There was not nearly as much squeamishness about bawdy jokes as there was in later centuries. And so I think that they would have enjoyed it quite heartily, as a matter of fact. So
it's reassuring, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
It's still happening. You see Much Ado About Nothing in one part of the country, it's acceptable in a different way than it is in a different part of our country. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not sure time as much as location might dictate that.
Yeah. David Ivers is with us, co-artistic director of the Utah Shakespeare Festival. He directs the production of Much Ado About Nothing. Kim Martin Cotton plays Beatrice in the production. Kate McPherson is with us. She's a professor of English and the director of the Honors Program at Utah Valley University. Much Ado About Nothing runs through September 8th here at the festival. You can find links and information about tickets on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are live at Cedar City at the Utah Shakespeare Festival. We're talking about one of the productions here. It's Much Ado About Nothing, giving us an opportunity to talk about the role of women in Shakespeare's plays. So, Kim, I wanted to ask you about this profound moment where Beatrice is furious because Claudio has besmirched the virtue of her beloved cousin, and she's out of her mind, crazy, angry, enraged, and she doesn't say anything at the moment at the wedding you mentioned, which I do find interesting. I guess she couldn't, but would you talk about this moment where she says she wishes she were a man?
Yes. I think part of the fury in this situation comes from not only the besmirching, but very much from her uncle, Leonardo, saying, I want her to die. I want her to die. She's done... He believes it, first of all, and then says the worst possible thing. So he goes from being this loving, incredible, open, accepting leader of this community to taking the word of the prince and Claudio and Don John and turning against her fairly quickly. I do think that that is one of the reasons that she doesn't say anything. I think she's shocked. Mm. But also when Leonardo is so strongly on this vocal course of what his daughter then deserves, that there's no room for her to speak, and to stand up against her uncle in public would have been, I think, would be radical. So I think that then all of this is welling up in her, so that in the following scene, where she may think she's going to be alone, and then Benedick returns in our staging of it, he leads her into conversation about her crying and her fury comes pouring out. And I do think that she is watching a whole bunch of men not take action And she wishes she were a man because she could then have stepped out and said something in public against these other men. And all these men are behaving badly from her perspective. So I do think that wishing to be a man, wishing to be a man and do something about this wrong is what she's longing for.
It's interesting, too. And this is kind of such a striking moment. And to be honest with you, I can't tell if you play it for laughs or you play it for the shock. There's a moment when she asks Benedict to kill Claudio.
Yes.
Claudio is Benedict's mate. He's his fellow soldier. They're bosom buddies. So this is a big deal that she's asking. And I wanted all of you, actually, to sort of talk about this. But Benedict says to her, are you sure in your soul that this is what you want? And she says, as sure as I have a thought or a soul. Like, I'm absolutely sure. Would you guys talk about this moment? Because this is such a powerful moment. And it's kind of striking and seemed funny but outrageous also.
Yeah, we've talked about this. You know, how do you circumvent the laugh? I don't know that you can. Audiences can't wait for it. I think, and the audience will have to tell us, I think, but I think part of the reason people laugh there is because they recognize that they're best friends. And she's asking him to do something that's what we've seen till now would be unthinkable.
It's shocking. You know? It's shocking.
It's just absolutely shocking. And also, it's a celebration of how utterly clear and strong Beatrice is. To have the capacity, the intelligence, and the clarity to say, this is what I want. And so it forces Benedict into a decision about his future. It forces Benedict to be more thoughtful, more intelligent, and more clear about his role in society and what society has given men, which is honor, which is the ability to do something about it. And I love the moment, and I love the scene where Benedict, as a character, gets to come in and say to Claudio, I'm serious. Here we go.
Yeah.
Because that's so romantic. You know what I mean? It's just, and it's so modern, you know? It's fairy tale wrapped in reality, wrapped back into fairy tale, wrapped into a clear social context and the difference between at the time what men had the ability to do and women do not. And it also speaks to a man who listened.
Yeah, it's the turning point in the play. I think that it's the moment when their relationship changes from one track onto another. It's like a switch, you know, literally on train tracks, where all of a sudden the train is going in a different direction because she's willing to make her voice heard so clearly. And as David said, he listens. And that alone is extraordinary. And it's part of what builds their love into what I think is one of the most realistic and mature love relationships that Shakespeare gives us, that they love each other not in spite of their faults, but because of them.
It's also masterful dramaturgy, masterful playwriting, masterful storytelling in that, and again, a very modern construct in a way. It's only modern because I think other dramatists have learned from it and have become part of our vocabulary. But structurally, that scene ends and we're waiting. Is it going to happen? We sandwich a bunch of scenes in there between, you know, we come back to it, we're leaning in saying, Is this where you listened?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's masterful, you know.
I was reading the scholar Stephen Greenblatt. He was writing about Much Ado About Nothing. He mentions how Beatrice and Benedict, they come together, even though he says they have this kind of, they've made this clear-eyed calculation about what could come of it. Like, they're realistic, we're gonna try this, but they have a clear-eyed sense of it. And he writes this, he says, but part of the magic of these plays is to register this calculation without inhibiting the joy and optimism of each of the couples. So I wanted to ask you about that finally, because David, you said, really, the play is joyous. Even though it's clear-eyed, there's a sense of hope to it.
Yeah, I mean, in all my experiences with it, I feel like people are in better hands at the end of the play and clearer about their future than they are at the beginning of the play, you know? And I said to the cast that we can do this a variety of ways, but I would prefer to do it with a kind of reckless abandonment, you know, a reckless mm-hmm. abandon, that these are characters that live their way into the 3D versions of themselves because of the other people that contextualize their life. And I can't find a better word than joyous when somebody, forgive the cheesiness, completes you.
Kim, would you say something about that, finally?
Yes. I think that going into the relationship with clarity about who they are to each other, who they've been to each other, opens up for a greater intimacy and depth. I mean, that's my experience in life, is the more clear-eyed you are going into a relationship that takes collaboration, the better. And so I do think that in the scene where we were talking about the Kill Claudio, that comes after the rush of admission of love and the warning, don't you eat your word, and then more confession of love, and then this bursting forth of, do this, what can I do for you? Do this for me.
Right.
Which I don't think is, it's just the truth. It is the truth. And he hesitates. And then by the end of the scene comes round two. He listens. He listens to her talk about what has just happened and asks her the question he needs to ask. And then with clarity comes to a place where they both are open, honest, completely without any kind of cover to say, we are in this together. And then I do think that it's wonderful at the end that you return to their sparring for a moment. In spite of themselves in public, they don't want to be the first to admit that they're in love with the other. But that there is a great, joyful understanding of self that is very needed when you have a great relationship with someone. So, yes, joy, 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 after a lot of fight to get there.
Kim Martin Cotton, she plays Beatrice in the Utah Shakespeare Festival's production of Much Ado About Nothing. David Ivers, co-artistic director of the festival, he directs the production. Kate McPherson was with us, professor of English and director of the Honors Program at Utah Valley University. Thank you all very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Much Ado About Nothing runs through September 8th at the Shakespeare Festival here in Cedar City. You can get links to information on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to James Matthews, to Jerry Carpenter, Michael Karchner, and Cami Paul Terry here at the Shakespeare Festival in Cedar City. Back in Salt Lake, thanks to Tim Slover. The show was directed today by Lewis Downey. Here's our engineer. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard, Andy Lane Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.